This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again, for the fifth time, from John Muir's book, The Story of My Boyhood and Youth, that he wrote the year before he died, in 1914. If you don't know much about John Muir, I urge you to read any of his writings, which can be found in used bookstores or online at sierraclub.org. Everything he wrote is available. I have found this to be a wonderful experience personally, to be reading these and learning so much about his work and his life. Muir was born in 1838 in Dunbar, Scotland, and his family moved to Wisconsin, near Montello, when he was 11, in 1849. These are priceless stories that take us into his world in those days. Last week, now settled in Wisconsin, he wrote about the birds he loved, especially. He has vivid descriptions of the passenger pigeons, and I read Aldo Leopold's On a Monument to the Pigeon, the talk that he gave when the monument at Wyalusing State Park was dedicated in 1947. All of my readings can be found at wdrt.org in the archived podcast. Before the arrival of farmers in the Wisconsin woods, the small ground squirrels called gophers lived chiefly on the seeds of wild grasses and weeds. But after the country was cleared and plowed, no feasting animal fell to more heartily on the farmers' wheat and corn. Increasing rapidly in numbers and knowledge, they became very destructive, especially in the spring when the corn was planted, for they learned to trace the rows and dig up and eat the three or four seeds in each hill about as fast as the poor farmers could cover them. And unless great pains were taken to diminish the numbers of the cunning little robbers, the fields had to be planted two or three times over, and even then large gaps in the rows would be found. The loss of the grain they consumed after it was ripe, together with the winter stores laid up in their burrows, amounted to little as compared with the loss of the seed on which the whole crop depended. One evening, about sundown, when my father sent me out with the shotgun to hunt them in a stubble field, I learned something curious and interesting in connection with these mischievous gophers, though just then they were doing no harm. As I strolled through the stubble, watching for a chance for a shot, a shrike flew past me and alighted on an open spot at the mouth of a burrow about 30 yards ahead of me. Curious to see what he was up to, I stood still to watch him. He looked down the gopher hole in a listening attitude and then looked back at me to see if I was coming, looked down again and listened, and looked back at me. I stood perfectly still, and he kept twitching his tail, seeming uneasy and doubtful about venturing to do the savage job that I soon learned he had on his mind. Finally, encouraged by my keeping so still, to my astonishment, he suddenly vanished in the gopher hole. A bird going down a deep, narrow hole in the ground, like a ferret or a weasel, seemed very strange, and I thought it would be a fine thing to run forward, clap my hand over the hole, and have the fun of imprisoning him and seeing what he would do when he tried to get out. So I ran forward, but stopped when I got within a dozen or 15 yards of the hole, thinking it might perhaps be more interesting to wait and see what would naturally happen without my interference. While I stood there looking and listening, I heard a great disturbance going on in the burrow, a mixed lot of keen squeaking, shrieking, distressful cries, telling that down in the dark something terrible was being done. Then suddenly out popped a half-grown gopher, 4.5 or 5 inches long, and without stopping a single moment to choose a way of escape, ran screaming through the stubble straight away from its home, quickly followed by another and another, until some half dozen were driven out, all of them crying and running in different directions, as if at this dreadful time, home sweet home was the most dangerous and least desirable of any place in the wide world. Then out came the shrike, flew above the runaway gopher children, and diving on them, killed them one after another with blows at the back of the skull. He then seized one of them, dragged it to the top of a small clod so as to be able to get a start, and laboriously made out to fly with it about 10 or 15 yards. Then he alighted to rest. Then he dragged it to the top of another clod and flew with it about the same distance, repeating this hard work over and over again, until he managed to get one of the gophers onto the top of a log fence. How much he ate of his hard-won prey, or what he did with the others, I can't tell, for by this time the sun was down and I had to hurry home to my chores. And that's the end of chapter 5. And now I'll start on chapter 6. At first, wheat, corn, and potatoes were the principal crops we raised, wheat especially. But in 4 or 5 years, the soil was so exhausted that only 5 or 6 bushels an acre, even in the better fields, was obtained. Although when first plowed, 20 and 25 bushels was about the ordinary yield. More attention was then paid to corn, but without fertilizers, the corn crop also became very meager. At last it was discovered that English clover would grow on even the exhausted fields, and that when plowed under and planted with corn or even wheat, wonderful crops were raised. This caused a complete change in farming methods. The farmers raised fertilizing clover, planted corn, and fed the crop to cattle and hogs. But no crop raised in our wilderness was so surprisingly rich and sweet and purely generous to us boys, and indeed to everybody, as the watermelons and muskmelons. We planted a large patch on a sunny hill slope the very first spring, and it seemed miraculous that a few handfuls of little flat seeds should in a few months send up 100 wagon loads of crisp, sumptuous, red-hearted and yellow-hearted fruits covering all the hill. We soon learned to know when they were in their prime and when overripe and mealy. Also, that if a second crop was taken from the same ground without fertilizing it, the melons would be small and what we call soapy, that is, soft and smooth, utterly uncrisp, and without a trace of the lively freshness and sweetness of those raised on virgin soil. Coming in from the farm work at noon, the half dozen or so of melons we had placed in our cold spring were a glorious luxury that only weary, barefooted farm boys can ever know. Spring was not very trying as to temperature, and refreshing rains fell at short intervals. The work of plowing commenced as soon as the frost was out of the ground. Corn and potato planting and the sowing of spring wheat was comparatively light work. While the nesting birds sang cheerily, grass and flowers covered the marshes and meadows and all the wild, uncleared parts of the farm, and the trees put forth their new leaves, those of the oaks forming beautiful purple masses, as if every leaf were a petal. And with all this we enjoyed the mild, soothing winds, the humming of innumerable small insects and hylas, and the freshness and fragrance of everything. Then, too, came the wonderful passenger pigeons streaming from the south, and flocks of geese and cranes filling all the sky with whistling wings. The summer work, on the contrary, was deadly heavy, especially harvesting and corn hoeing. All the ground had to be hoed over. For the first few years before Father bought cultivators or small weed-covering plows, and we were not allowed a moment's rest. The hoes had to be kept working up and down as steadily as if they were moved by machinery. Plowing for winter wheat was comparatively easy when we walked barefoot in the furrows, while the fine autumn tints kindled in the woods and the hillsides were covered with golden pumpkins. In summer, the chores were grinding scythes, feeding the animals, chopping stove wood, and carrying water up the hill from the spring on the edge of the meadow. Then breakfast, and to the harvest or hayfield. I was foolishly ambitious to be the first in mowing and cradling, and by the time I was 16, led all the hired men. An hour was allowed at noon for dinner and more chores. We stayed in the field until dark, then supper, and still more chores, family worship, and to bed, making altogether a hard, sweaty day of about 16 or 17 hours. Think of that, ye blessed 8-hour-day laborers. In winter, Father came to the foot of the stairs and called us at 6 o'clock to feed the horses and cattle, grind axes, bring in wood, and do any other chores required, then breakfast and out to work in the mealy, frosty snow by daybreak, chopping, fencing, and so on. So in general, our winter work was about as restless and trying as that of the long day summer. No matter what the weather, there was always something to do. During heavy rains or snowstorms, we worked in the barn, shelling corn, fanning wheat, thrashing with the flail, making axe handles or ox yokes, mending things, or sprouting and sorting potatoes in the cellar. No pains were taken to diminish or in any way soften the natural hardships of this pioneer farm life, nor did any of the Europeans seem to know how to find reasonable ease and comfort, if they would. The very best oak and hickory fuel was embarrassingly abundant and cost nothing but cutting and common sense. But instead of hauling great, heart-cheering loads of it for wide-open, all-welcoming, climate-changing, beauty-making, godlike ingle fires, it was hauled with weary, heartbreaking industry into fences and waste places to get it out of the way of the plow and out of the way of doing good. The only fire for the whole house was the kitchen stove, with a firebox about 18 inches long and 8 inches wide and deep, scant space for 3 or 4 small sticks, around which in hard zero weather all the family of 10 persons shivered, and beneath which in the morning we found our socks and coarse, soggy boots frozen solid. We were not allowed to start even this despicable little fire in its black box to thaw them. No, we had to squeeze our throbbing, aching, chilblained feet into them, causing greater pain than toothache, and hurry out to chores. Fortunately, the miserable, chilblained pain began to abate as soon as the temperature of our feet approached the freezing point, enabling us, in spite of hard work and hard frost, to enjoy the winter beauty, the wonderful radiance of the snow when it was starry with crystals, and the dawns and the sunsets and white noons, and the cheery, enlivening company of the brave chickadees and nuthatches. The winter stars far surpassed those of our stormy Scotland in brightness, and we gazed and gazed as though we had never seen stars before. Oftentimes the heavens were made still more glorious by auroras, the long lance rays called merry dancers in Scotland, streaming with startling, tremulous motion into the zenith. Usually the electric auroral light is white or pale yellow, but in the third or fourth of our Wisconsin winters, there was a magnificently colored aurora that was seen and admired over nearly all the continent. The whole sky was draped in graceful purple and crimson folds, glorious beyond description. This celestial show was far more glorious than anything we had ever beheld, and throughout that wonderful winter, hardly anything else was spoken of. Nature has many ways of thinning and pruning and trimming her forests. Lightning strokes, heavy snow, and storm winds to shatter and blow down whole trees here and there, or break off branches as required. The results of these methods I have observed in different forests, but only once have I seen pruning by rain. The rain froze on the trees as it fell and grew so thick and heavy that many of them lost a third or more of their branches. The view of the woods after the storm had passed and the sun shone forth was something never to be forgotten. Every twig and branch and rugged trunk was encased in pure crystal ice, and each oak and hickory and willow became a fairy crystal palace. Such dazzling brilliance, such effects of white light and irised light glowing and flashing, I had never seen before, nor have I since. This sudden change of the leafless woods to glowing silver was like the great aurora spoken of for years, and is one of the most beautiful of the many pictures that enriches my life. And besides the great shows, there were thousands of others, even in the coldest weather, manifesting the utmost fineness and tenderness of beauty and affording noble compensation for hardship and pain. One of the most striking of the winter sounds was the loud roaring and rumbling of the ice on our lake, from its shrinking and expanding with the changes of the weather. The fishermen who were catching pickerel said that they had no luck when this roaring was going on above the fish. I remember how frightened we boys were when, on one of our New Year holidays, we were taking a walk on the ice and heard for the first time the sudden rumbling roar beneath our feet, and running on ahead of us, creaking and whooping as if all the ice 18 or 20 inches thick was breaking. In the neighborhood of our Wisconsin farm, there were extensive swamps consisting in great part of a thick sod of very tough carex roots covering thin, watery lakes of mud. They originated in glacier lakes that were gradually overgrown. This sod was so tough that oxen with loaded wagons could be driven over it without cutting down through it, although it was afloat. The carpenters who came to build our frame house noticed how the sedges sunk beneath their feet, said that if they should break through, they would probably be well on their way to California before touching bottom. On the contrary, all these lake basins are shallow as compared with their width. When we went into the Wisconsin woods, there was not a single wheel track or cattle track. The only man-made road was an Indian trail along the Fox River between Portage and Packwaukee Lake. Of course, the deer, foxes, badgers, coons, skunks, and even the squirrels had well-beaten tracks from their dens and hiding places in thickets, hollow trees, and the ground, but they did not reach far, and but little noise was made by the soft-footed travelers in passing over them, only a slight rustling and swishing among fallen leaves and grass. Although in the spring of 1849 there was no other settler within a radius of 4 miles of our Fountain Lake farm, in 3 or 4 years almost every quarter section of government land was taken up, mostly by enthusiastic home seekers from Great Britain, with only here and there Yankee families from adjacent states who had come drifting indefinitely westward in covered wagons, seeking their fortunes like winged seeds, all alike striking root and gripping the glacial drift soil as naturally as oak and hickory trees, happy and hopeful, establishing homes and making wider and wider fields in the hospitable wilderness. The axe and plow were kept very busy. Cattle, horses, sheep, and pigs multiplied. Barns and corn cribs were filled up, and man and beast were well fed. A schoolhouse was built, which was used also for a church, and in a very short time the new country began to look like an old one. And I'll stop there, and next week I'll continue reading The Story of My Boyhood and Youth by John Muir. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.